you all for joining us today here on Elevate, broadcasting from the Razorback Camper Sales Studio. This National Park College podcast highlights a different Nighthawk with each episode. We'll talk about their journey, challenges, key moments of success, their moments of elevation, leveling up, and overcoming.
I'm Timothy Webb, your host, and I'd like to welcome to the program Jason Chisholm. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's good to be here, Tim.
So, Jason, we've talked a little bit in the past. You've had quite an interesting life. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I teach English here at the college. I actually started out as a philosophy teacher here years ago. All of my interest and research have been very interdisciplinary, both my undergraduate and graduate degree. I've looked at the kind of the intersection of language and literature with history and philosophy and all kinds of other things. My master's thesis, which I'll mention and we'll skip right over because it's like watching paint dry, it was actually on psychosemiotics. It's a small group of people who care about that. I think it's really interesting. So semiotics, briefly, is a study of signs. And this could be anything from rain cloud indicating rain to the most sophisticated system of signs, language. Every sound coming out of my mouth, we translate as a sign. Mm-hmm. Most of my writing and research has been on semiotics, but particularly how we create and understand signs. And my thesis focused on looked at the self as a particular kind of sign. Mm. It's a metaphor, and I'm going to stop there because it gets really it's like watching paint dry for most people.
Well, not for me in particular. I actually am a philosophy major, so that's pretty interesting stuff to me. Yeah.
We have so much in common.
We really do.
Also, I should also mention, really the love of my life for my kids. I'm the father of two, one 10 and one 20-year-old. And I've had a really wild life. I grew up in Southwest Arkansas. I've lived all over Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., briefly in L.A., studied in London for a little bit. Yeah, there's all kinds of stories along the way. Almost really got close to joining the circus at one point in my life.
Oh, my gosh.
I was going to be Ringling Brothers piano player for a minute.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Ringling Brothers piano player. Every 10-year-old's dream. So, Jason, right now, what's your current position here at National Park?
I'm an assistant professor of English.
Okay.
I'm also the co-advisor for Phi Theta Kappa, the International Honor Society.
So you said philosophy and now English. Which one's your favorite subject and why did you choose that subject?
That's a tough question.
It is a tough question, isn't it?
I don't know that I could live without both.
Right.
Yeah, so actually to answer the question of how did I choose that, I chose to major in English. Well, one, I wish you the best of luck, but I was very concerned that a degree in philosophy would put me on a path to Walmart.
Yes, I understand. I understand. It's a very particular...
It is. I think it is the first liberal art. It is the grandfather of all subjects. It is. You're not going to get me to say anything bad about the subject. I think it's great. I moved to English, one, because it's more marketable. But two, I found that as I am more and more interested in literature and got deeper and deeper, all of those interests that I had with history and political science and philosophy, and they were all there. This is the study of literature is a study of humanity and those ideas. In fact, I think sometimes some writers, not many, but some writers actually have been able to develop some explanations of the world and some philosophical ideas, even better than some philosophers can. Because as you know, philosophers can get a little wordy.
You know, I was once trying to explain to some people what I was having to read in class, and I was like, it's kind of like reading lawyer documents from the 1600s.
Exactly. Yes.
It's very wordy, very jargon-filled. As us philosophers know, those particulars are important to our arguments. We're trying to be extremely specific.
Absolutely. You cannot get to anything of truth until you understand the words that you're using and how you're using those words, which goes back to semiotics, that sign, that word is a sign. We need to understand how we're interpreting this sign.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I'll stop with semiotics. People are going to turn this off.
No, no, I don't think so. How long have you been at National Park College?
So as a full-time instructor about a year and a half. This is my, I think, my 16th year in higher education. I came from an institution that I had spent 11 years at, but National Park was actually the first college to hire me as an adjunct. So this was my first job, and that was as a philosophy instructor, and I have been wanting to come back ever since then.
Yeah. So, Jason, you're the assistant professor of English here at National Park. What all does that position entail?
A lot of grading. It entails lecturing. There's a lot of work behind the scenes, including research and continuing to stay, you know, up to date in my field. Because we're moving into kind of a brave new world, it involves a lot of working with technology. I have taught online classes just about since I started teaching, but technology changes, the world changes, and I think we're all still in the middle of learning how to effectively teach online. So there's a lot of time spent on how to improve my online classes. I'm one that it would probably serve my mental health to stop this, but every year I rethink how I teach my classes. I restructure the classes. Part of it is to keep it fresh for me, but language is an alive thing. It's changing all the time. So with my composition classes, I need to stay up to date on that. But even things that look like they should be kind of set in place, like literature, well, our students change, and we have to find different approaches to reach the students that we have. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work.
Yeah.
And a lot of grading.
Yeah, a lot of grading. To touch on one of your points, as a current student that takes a lot of online classes, and I know each subject is different, but it would be nice if at least in each college that the online layout format would be the same.
This is a soapbox of mine.
Because each instructor does it their way. Like in particular, I had a class this last semester we're finishing up now. We use Blackboard on all our other classes. This particular instructor decided he doesn't like Blackboard. He's going to use Google Classroom.
Wow.
It was a totally different layout from what I was used to. And then even in Blackboard, the philosophy classes are taught way differently than, say, the history classes.
Yes.
And, you know, the layouts, just how you get the information.
Yes. That's been a soapbox of mine. I'm very conscientious about how I structure my class, but I've had two this semester that could not make heads or tails out of how my class was structured because they were used to something else. And it is very frustrating when you spend weeks and weeks and weeks really thinking about how to structure your class, and then it's not intuitive because they're used to something else.
Right.
And I'm fine with adapting, but I need to know what that looks like.
What's the format going to be across campus?
I completely agree with you on that.
So we kind of touched on this a little bit, but can you mention some of the challenges you face as a professor or assistant professor in English?
Pretty much anyone in education right now, if you get them talking long enough, it's going to be, COVID's going to be brought up. This was, I think, a particularly rough semester as a teacher, probably as a student as well, because I was going in very excited that COVID is over. Mm-hmm. But found out very quickly that we still have a lot of residual effects of COVID. I think on both ends, it's hard to stay motivated after these last 2 years. The students in particular, this semester didn't show up. They didn't turn in assignments on time. I think a lot of this is after effects of COVID. So a challenge from the very beginning of teaching, I think it's one of the greatest challenges, but I think it's the mark of a good teacher, is being able to ask yourself, why do I understand this? How do I understand this? Most of the time when we go into a field, we're probably good at it. And it's probably natural to us.
Right.
And I think one of the hardest things to do, but one of the most vital things to do as an educator, is to kind of deconstruct how you know this, why you're good at this. Somewhere along the line, something made sense to you and you put in the back of your mind, right? Mm-hmm. And I've constantly tried to do that. Ask, why am I good at writing? How do I understand this? How did I learn to do analysis? And that's a constant question, because you're constantly learning more about yourself and how you think. You're constantly trying to find a way to translate that. But even when you start to get your hands around that, you have a different group of students, a new generation. And all those answers that you had before are out the window now, because you're dealing with a different population now.
Right, right. Everybody's really good at something, I think. And I've came across individuals that would make, to me, it was the most absurd logic fallacies. but they're brilliant in another way. I don't understand why your intelligence doesn't translate over to these other subjects.
We're going to have to have a talk after this. You're hitting on every... I tell you this, that's kind of connected. That's one thing over the last year that has changed dramatically in my Composition 1 class is I have tripled the amount of time that I spend on logical fallacies. Mm-hmm. Now, 10 years ago, I would mention it in passing, basically. Yeah. And what I'm seeing more and more of is this inability to recognize your own faulty logic. And I think probably next year I'm going to add more time to that because I think it's one of the most important things I do now.
We do appreciate you adding time to that. So are there any common myths you'd like to clear up about being an English teacher?
There's quite a few. Usually, most of them have to do with the work that we do. So this idea that we have the summers off. I have often not taught classes during the summer, but I have never had a summer off. So this is where we do research. This is where we prepare. There's a lot of work that goes into the summer. Now, granted, I get to do it in my pajamas with a cup of coffee at home, but I'm still working, sometimes even harder than I would in the normal semester. Kind of along with that, this idea that whatever hours we post on our door are the hours that we work. So on average, whatever time they have me on campus, you can add 20 hours a week to that at home. Because I will be grading at home when the kids go to bed. So we put in a lot more hours than it looks. I don't know of any other field that requires so much education and pays so little. But then I guess the only other thing, just personally, being particularly with English, is it's kind of a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. It's so common that people ask me, what do you do? I'm a college English teacher. Well, I watch my grammar around you. We're not like that. We don't do that. I don't speak proper English always.
Right, right.
And I don't judge people or hear it most of the time.
Right, right. You're still a person, aren't you?
I'm still a person.
But you do probably write better than
hopefully,
most.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
I will judge you on Facebook for bad grammar.
For your posts.
Yeah. If you've had time to think it through and type it out, then you should get it right.
I'm sure we all go through this, but me in particular, I cringe at some of my posts from 10 to 15 years ago because I'm like, well, I can't believe I let my grammar slip. I didn't even capitalize I.
Yeah, that happens even for English teachers. Mm.
So what are some of the biggest obstacles you've had to overcome to get to where you are today, Jason?
The first thing that comes to mind, it wasn't until recently in my life that I realized how big of an obstacle it was, how much it played into my self-identity. But I came from a small town in southwest Arkansas from a very poor family. Those obstacles with poverty, with parents who weren't able to go to college, navigating through college, being able to go to college, and then navigating through that, there were just the smallest things were big challenges for me in the first few years. It took a while to learn that. And then after I did, particularly in grad school, I suffered greatly from kind of this imposter syndrome, which I have since learned some of the smartest people I've known and some of the smartest people I went to school with had the same thing, that you get there, they're going to find me out. I don't belong here. I'm not smart enough. And I suffered greatly from that. I realized, though, in life that true dummies never, ever think that, right?
Yeah. We're going to get into the Dunning-Kruger effect here.
Yeah.
For our folks that don't know, the Dunning-Kruger effect is if you're really good at something, you're always questioning that you're maybe not that good at it. And if you're not good at it, you think you're great at it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can you tell us how it felt when you overcame that imposter effect?
Yeah, I think it impacted me profoundly, kind of on two levels. One, it was how I overcame it is I worked harder than everyone else because I didn't think I belonged. Now, this was very different from my undergraduate. I might not have belonged then. I have a very checkered undergraduate degree. I don't want any of my students to get a hold of that transcript. But I worked hard. For instance, my master's thesis, first of all, I picked psychosemiotics, which is like a little over the top, you know. And then I think the thesis ended up being like 130 pages.
Wow.
It was way over what was required. And all that was insecurity. I was overcompensating for my own inadequacies. But what happened is over and over and over, I achieved.
Right.
And I kind of produced things that were at the top. And eventually, even someone who is as hard-headed as I can be, especially about myself, you start to build evidence that, okay, a dummy couldn't have done this.
Right.
But there's got to be something to you.
Yes.
And so eventually that's what happened. And then once I kind of accepted, yeah, I'm pretty smart. In a sense, it was kind of the opposite of what you would expect. First, there was this freedom. I felt that monkey off of my back. And it, I guess the opposite of what you would expect is, and maybe I'm kind of psychoanalyzing myself now, but maybe my fear all along with that was that if I accepted it, it would come across as egotistical. Mm. And I don't want to be that.
Right.
But the opposite happened. I felt so humble from that. I kind of accepted, I'm pretty smart. I'm pretty good at this. And instead of, I felt more confident, but also very humble because it helped me to kind of identify with what other people kind of go through and and how little we make ourselves. And so I, in a way, it connected me to other people and their struggles.
Sure, What are some of the achievements you're most proud of?
Well, I would say just academically, the work that I did do in graduate school. In my career, I've been put into positions and recognized for different things that, you know, I could talk about that, but that honestly really doesn't bring me very, very much pride. It's, if I'm going to be honest about that, really, when I feel like I've achieved something in my life, it's more those moments that I, and oftentimes I don't realize them when they're happening, that I've taken the time to provide support, encouragement, sometimes criticism to a student that made a difference, mm-hmm. and they've done something with that. They've become something. So it's not taking credit for their achievements, but it makes me really proud when I've heard that at least for a moment, I was able to be present and say the right thing to a student that had a, to me, it probably insignificant, but I've had several that have come back and said that this is a life-changing moment for them. And I'm both very humbled and extremely, extremely proud of those moments.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what being a teacher is about, I think, isn't it?
I hope so.
Yeah. So you touched on this a little bit, but where'd you grow up and what was it like there?
So I grew up in a small town in southwest Arkansas, Mineral Springs.
Oh, wow.
Do you know Mineral Springs?
I do know Mineral Springs. My school used to play y'all's school.
Oh, what school are you?
I went to Caddo Hills.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you're from a pretty small town,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'm from a small town.
One thing about Mineral Springs that I feel extraordinarily lucky, I feel lucky for growing up in a small town like that. Didn't at the time, but later I did. In Mineral Springs, growing up, it was the most diverse small town in that area. I wasn't aware of it. I had an experience of growing up not having friends of different cultures and races. I didn't have a friend, you know, a black friend, a Asian friend. They were my friends, right? And we lived in each other's culture. Not anything that I was aware of as a child. It was just my upbringing. It wasn't until I was well into college before I started realizing how exceptional this was, that I not only knew people of different races and cultures, but lived in those cultures. And I think that had an incredible, profound effect on who I am and what I value today, and I feel extraordinarily lucky.
For local content like this and much more, subscribe to the Sentinel Record by visiting hotsr.com and clicking subscribe.
Tell us about an influential person on your life and how they impacted your life.
Oh, there are many, many. I've been very fortunate to know some incredible people. In fact, I just had a birthday this week.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And actually, that's what struck me, is to not only see just the number of Facebook likes and happy birthday wishes, but the extraordinary people who were on it. I just felt so lucky, the people that have been or are in my life. It doesn't take me long when I start thinking about this to bring up Bill Gentry, who was actually the one who introduced me to philosophy.
Okay.
He was an institution at Henderson. He may be the most brilliant professor they'd ever had. He started the Honors College. He started the Master of Liberal Arts degree, the one that I earned there. He taught generations of students here. And the one story that you would hear about Bill Gentry over and over and over went something like this. I took him for a philosophy of religion. And you'd go in 1 week and you'd leave the class thinking, well, I didn't know that Dr. Gentry was Muslim. And I go, that's surprising. I don't know how he became a Muslim. And then the next week you'd leave and go, I don't know why he thought he was Muslim. He's obviously Hindu. And then the next week, I don't know what I was thinking. He's clearly an atheist, right? And because he taught with such incredible knowledge, but also passion, that it wasn't, you could not accept that a man who taught a subject with that much passion just knew it. He had to believe it. And as a teacher, that is the most inspirational person in my life. But we then became really close friends. I wasn't going to say this, but I'll share this with you because you'll appreciate this. Through his friendship, I saw just an extraordinary life. I mean, he was the embodiment of the examined life. When I knew him, he was in the early stages of Parkinson's, and we all knew that Parkinson's would take over eventually. We couldn't think of a worse fate for a man like this for his body to go, but the mind to still be there. That's horrible. I had moved away to Austin for a while, and he was the first person I contacted when I decided to move back. In that time, he had been diagnosed with lymphoma, and his time was going to be very short. But we had spent, you know, countless hours over the years discussing life and the meaning of life. We became close because when I was taking him in class, my mother was dying. Hmm. Oh, I can go on and on about that, but what a special guy. And he helped me through that. But when I moved back, he said, I want to ask you for a favor. If you can't do this, it's okay. But he says, I've always appreciated your sensitivity and your philosophical mind. And I want to experience this like I've experienced life, to try to find the truth of it, the meaning. If you're up for it, I want you to come over once a week and discuss dying. And I got to be that guy.
Wow.
Which is single-handedly the greatest honor of my life. It was a hard, hard thing to do, but it was such an incredible honor. Wow. So his whole life, from how he lived it to how he ended it, everything about that man is an example to me in the classroom and out.
Wow. Wow. What an impact he must have had, and what an impact you must have had on him. Jason, if you could give your younger self any piece of advice, what would it be?
Stay present. Mm. Stay present. I spent much of my teens, 20s, probably half of my 30s, either regretting things that I'd done or worried about what's going to happen. And, you know, looking back, I had the most wonderful experiences, some great moments in my life that should have been a lot more joyful than they were. Only thing keeping me from experiencing that joy was I wasn't in the moment. You know, I would just tell them, you know, things are going to work out. They're going to be okay. Just enjoy the ride. Enjoy the moments.
Other than National Park College, what hobbies do you have? What's your interests?
Well, Timothy, you know one. I think we met. My deepest love is music. I'm in part a teacher of English because the rock star didn't work out.
yeah.
I love it. I didn't major in music in college. Actually, I could have got scholarships, but I turned those down because music is so personal to me that I don't think I could ever teach it. I couldn't deal with the frustrations of students not loving as much as I did.
So right.
Huge fan of music. Tying back to my childhood, too, I'm in love with culture. I love travel. I love seeing new places. And kind of related to that, I've become kind of a foodie. I'm a pretty darn good cook. And I love to go experience different foods, learn techniques, and kind of make that part of my life, too.
Well, we look forward to your dish at the potluck for the holiday party coming up.
I forgot about that. This might not have been a good time to give that answer.
So, Jason, what is it about cooking that drew you to it?
I think in the beginning, being from a small southern town, cooking's a big part of our culture, a big part of our life. As a little child, my mother and grandmother started to teach me to cook. My mother would never label herself this way, but there was a feminist streak through her. She wanted me to be able to cook, one, so that when I went off to college, I wouldn't eat just a bunch of junk. Mm-hmm. And two, when I eventually got married, I wouldn't make my wife do all the cooking.
Right.
I guess it started with kind of a connection with my mother and grandmother. But then in college, I was just so fascinated by new ways of cooking, new tastes. I was very fortunate to developed close friendships with people all over the world and learned early on that the best way, the fastest and most effective way to connect with someone of a different culture is to sit down at a table with them. That is where culture and love is communicated.
Wow.
One of my dear friends in college, he comes from a culture that he used to cook for me often. And he comes from a culture who he said they believe that if you cook for a person, then you're not allowed to war with them ever.
Wow. That's awesome. I wish everybody had that.
Honestly, I believe we could solve a lot of the world's problems if we just sat down at a table.
Yeah.
There's a lot to learn from each other through food.
That's some good stuff.
And it just tastes good, you know?
Yeah.
You just learn to appreciate more.
If you could talk to anyone from the past, present, or even future, who would it be and why?
Not only every day of my life could this change, but probably every few hours I would give a different answer.
Yeah. Who is it this hour?
Well, I suppose the one consistent answer would be able to talk with my mother again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my grandmother, too, would be there. One, just to let my mom know that things worked out. They're okay. With my grandmother, she was a high school English teacher.
Oh.
The most intelligent person I had ever seen. I remember watching her watch Jeopardy, mm-hmm. and never remember her not answering a question before the contestants did.
Wow.
It was amazing. She could recite every single Robert Frost poem. Mm-hmm. She's just a wealth of knowledge and an incredible model of hard work for an education. And I've often thought that it would be nice to be able to talk to her because she passed away when I was in high school. Yeah. So it would have been nice to have a conversation after I learned a little something.
Right, you know? Right. So what are your future plans?
Professionally, there's a couple of papers that I'm interested in writing. Mm-hmm. Maybe this summer I can finally have time to do that. Maybe not.
Yeah.
We'll see. There are some areas of research that I'd like to contribute to. On campus, I've gotten involved with the honors program here.
Mm-hmm.
I am very excited about the potential there. I want to continue to help develop it and participate in it and help it to flourish. I've also this year taken on the travel abroad program.
Mm.
We've had incredible response. We are planning a trip May of 2024 to Italy and Greece. Really looking forward to that. In fact, if any of your listeners are interested, contact me at jason.chisholm@np.edu. But I would like to see this program develop and be something we can rely on, that it's kind of set in stone. We're going to have an international trip, if not every year, at least every other year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really looking forward to working hard to make that happen.
Wow, how exciting. That's awesome. Here at National Park College.
And by the way, Timothy, staff and faculty can tag along. Uh-huh. And for a philosopher, I don't know if there's a better place to go than Italy and Greece.
I don't think there is. I think you're right. Jason, is there any advice or any quotes or mottos you live by you'd like to share with our listeners?
I generally try not to give advice. I learned that in my 20s. It could come back at you.
But right.
What I would say is that I think the most attractive characteristic for a human being is authenticity. I think if there's any hope of finding real meaning and happiness in life, it can't happen without developing yourself as an authentic person. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in order to do that, you have to make experiences happen for you. You have to say yes to things. You mm-hmm. have to go places, talk to people, put down your phones, and make yourself uncomfortable. We don't grow when we're comfortable. So I guess if I had any advice, it would be to adamantly fight for authenticity. And you do that through taking advantage of the experiences around you and creating experiences when there's not.
Awesome. Yes, that's some good advice from the non-advisor. Jason Chisholm, it has been awesome sitting down and talking with you today. I've really enjoyed it.
I have too, Timothy. I hope you can use some of this.
I'm sure there's a lot we can use. Thank you so much.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Elevate Today from the Razorback Camper Sales Studio. New episodes are released each Thursday. Special thanks to National Park College and the Sentinel Record for making this podcast possible. Until next time, this is Timothy Webb reminding you that every day is a chance to elevate.